So, Bob, I have some emails from patrons that they would like you and I to read and then respond to. What do you say, Bob?
That sounds good. You think we'll get through some today?
Yeah. This is the Psychology of Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor and someone who mostly enjoys the dreary days of winter in Seattle. Who are you?
You're in one now. It is really raining.
Yeah.
Gray.
Yeah. We're both looking out the window right now. It's like the way weather is in Seattle for like probably 6 months. It's overcast, raining, but just slightly.
Mm.
And about 55 degrees.
Yeah.
I don't know how many Celsius that is. Everything's wet, standing water everywhere.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a misty green, you know, lots of green you see in the backyard, trees
and green.
Bushes and, you know, wildlife. And I have my hummingbird feeder out, and it's just a very, Northwest kind of situation.
Do you get hummingbirds?
I do.
Do you get them this time of year?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm jealous, man. I totally want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd think they would, but maybe we get ones that are coming down. I don't know anyway. But who are you, Bob?
I'm a person without a hummingbird feeder. That's who I am. a therapist in practice here in Seattle, and you and me have been friends for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, first email, patron Molly says, I'm wondering if you and Bob would talk about the following. As evolved as Bob is around his disorganized attachment style, I can't help but wonder if he ever encounters frustrations in his relationships or intimate relationships where he feels as though the fault always falls on him and his disorganized style when conflicts arise. I mean, it takes two to tango after all.
Sure.
How does he respond with awareness and compassion and resolution while not taking on all the blame? I'm asking because he shares the stories about conflict and how his disorganized attachment contributed to having a breakdown. He seems to sound, breakdown, I think she means conflicts that you've had, that you've shared, you know, where you've, you know,
no doubt,
been
right.
in the doldrums of your mood or something.
Right.
He seems to sound like his wife is never part of the problem.
Oh.
It's always his disorganized style which contributed to the problem. Bob, what do you think?
I like this question. I'm glad this person's asking. Because I agree, it does take two to tango. And I don't talk about Colleen because I respect her privacy and she hasn't consented. So I usually just talk about my side of things. I'll say this, when I'm in conflict, my first instinct is to blame. So one of the benefits of being on the podcast is that I get at the moment a little distance and a little reflection so I can actually see, oh yeah, that's that thing I do as opposed to that's that thing she does.
But, right. If I barged into your house in the middle of one of your conflicts and shoved a microphone in your face and asked you to talk about what just happened, it would be a different tone.
It would indeed. Yeah, it would be a different tone. I'd be very probably angry and probably blaming and believing the things that I think and having that kind of delicious, one-sided, righteous thing that I get sometimes. And only when the dust settles and my mood shifts, you know, like just a little bit of time, let the body settle and all that. Because it's fight or flight. Gets turned on. Do I actually have perspective? And one of the things that I noticed lately is underneath anger, and it's not so far underneath now. It used to be way underneath. But these days, underneath, all I want is connection with her. And I get so damn angry. But underneath it, all I want is a connection. And all I expect is, you know, conflict. So that said, I can say the following. Colleen and I are both trauma survivors. And so it's pretty tricky for us. And we get pulled into that cycle more easily than I'd like and probably more easily than a lot of couples.
And Colleen is, quote unquote, to blame for her side of the conflict.
Yeah, I don't know if it's my favorite thing, but it's one of the things that I remember about her from way back in the beginning. She's the only person I ever dated who, after one of these conflicts, would say, okay, let's come back, let's try again, here's my part.
Wow.
Great. I've never had a partner like that before.
Yeah. The mindset of who's to blame, you're already losing the battle.
Absolutely. That's a great sentence.
And I've been there. And will continue to be there. But when I reach a point where I can see the conflict from a mile high, what I see is two people trying and reacting in very normal, understandable ways.
Yeah.
To the point where it spins out of control. I mean, almost everything that we are reacting to in a conflict is a distortion of what's really happening.
Indeed.
And sometimes our partners don't make it easy on us. You know, they're yelling at us, for example, mm-hmm. when really they're hurting. And so it's right. easy to, quote unquote, distort that as being not hurt, I guess. But most, you know, by the time you get to a certain age, particularly in a relationship, it's not hard to imagine, oh, that anger comes from a place of hurt.
Yeah.
The trick is to be as self-aware as you can, right? And as we always talk about, we only have control over our thoughts and behavior. We don't have control over our partners. And so if each person takes responsibility for their area of the lawn, then the lawn will get mowed well. And so it's funny, it was just a little peek behind the curtains of my brain. Uh-huh. I wanted to say, you know, if we tidy up our side of the fence, but that sort of implied there's a barrier between the two right. people, which not I didn't really like. And so I right. modified it to just, we're both in the front lawn of, yep. of the house. And then it became a metaphor about mowing lawns together, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, it makes sense as an analogy, but it's not very compelling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, right. We should do one on metaphor sometime.
Oh God. Yeah.
It could be really fun. Metaphors are great.
Yeah. So I recommend that people do what Bob does, which is recognize your part and just put a period at the end of that. And when you do that, it tends to encourage the other person to follow suit.
Yeah.
And it's so tempting to say, okay, well, here's my responsibility, but you know, you... Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, absolutely.
And then you're back into it again. Right.
And when I do that, I'm missing something in me, some part of me, some vulnerable part of me that I don't want to, and also sometimes just don't have access to. If I'm blaming, I'm in it.
Yeah. Another aspect to this is one needs to have a certain level of what we call differentiation. One might call maturity. One might call... enough validation from others or something to be able to stand firmly on the ground and state without any reservation, I've made a mistake, period.
Yeah.
And I don't require anyone to make me feel better.
Right.
I don't require anyone to, you know, say, no, you didn't do that. Like, you are able to stand in front of a crowd of people and just say, I have made a mistake.
Yeah.
And that is not an easy thing to do.
It isn't.
And one needs a lot of experience with that and having it go well and not having it go horribly to be able to trust that. One also needs to like oneself enough and think of oneself in high enough esteem to be able to handle that kind of thing. I've worked in my career with people of all ages, and it was always a little chuckle in my mind whenever I was talking to a 13-year-old, and a very obvious thing would come up in which the teenager was to blame, and I'd sort of throw it out there the way I might with an adult. And most adults would be like, yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah.
Teenagers almost universally be like, what are you talking about? No. Yeah. You know, because they're so insecure. You know, they just don't, not all of them, obviously,
sure.
but generally speaking, they don't have that maturity. They don't have that differentiation, that ability to just be like, okay, yeah, I'm me and I'm over here and sure, I make mistakes, you know, what's it to you?
Right.
So that's hard, you know, that, and for some people, they haven't reached that point yet, or they've never been given a chance to explore that that kind of space.
Yeah.
They've never been modeled it maybe before. I don't know. I mean, that certainly is true. Hardly anyone's been. I mean, just look at politicians for crying out loud.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. I don't want to do a podcast on politicians.
Yeah. And also, you know, just pops into my mind in terms of when people do take responsibility. I think of like sports figures. Yeah. Like a very common trope is for coaches to come out after the game, after a loss, and say like, this is all my fault.
Yeah.
But everyone kind of knows like, well, they're doing that because it looks bad for them to blame their players.
Sure.
And the coach is kind of like the dad of the team.
Yeah.
And so he has to say, it's my fault.
Yeah, the buck stops with me.
Yeah. And the way like a police captain or a general or something.
Right.
But everyone understands when they go behind closed doors, they're not like crying themselves into a heap saying like, oh my God, I can't believe I screwed up.
Sorry guys, my fault, right? They're not saying that to the team.
Right. Yeah. Or at least they're not thinking it,
probably
you know?
Not.
They're saying, look, you know, I made X and Y mistake, but you know, countless other players made mistakes too. So even when people do take responsibility in our society, it tends to be understood like it's a ceremony, or it's a ritual,
that they're
following. It kind of is.
It is.
You know, like
Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
Super Bowl.
Right.
Right.
Right. Well, that was his fault, goddammit. I mean, fucking give it to Lynch. It's obvious.
Right, everybody in Seattle is.
Did you see my decade recap video? Oh, you're not on Facebook.
No, is it on? Did you post it?
Yeah.
No, I'll look at it.
So, one scene, you know, in 2014 is at your house watching the Super Bowl and us winning.
Oh, God,
and your dog, and everyone's cheering, and the dog's like, your dog starts to bark.
Nice.
And then the next year, you know, watching the Super Bowl. And we're like, okay, give it to Lynch, you know? And then, yeah, it was anyway. So, getting back to your email, Patron Molly. Now what I will say is that you deserve, so for Bob and Colleen both individually they've been together for many years. They've gone to therapy. They've had a lot of conversations. Bob has the trust in Colleen and in himself, you know, over lots of experiences that he can fully take responsibility and quote unquote blame himself for his side of the conflict while on the podcast, and trust that when Colleen hears that, she's not going to blast him. She's going to thank him, and she's going to take responsibility for her part. He feels that in his bones. For you, Patron Molly, you know, you might be thinking, well, I have conflicts with my spouse, and, you know, Bob takes full responsibility for his issues and, you know, on the podcast doesn't blame other people. You know, and maybe Patron Molly's like, am I supposed to be like that?
Yeah, sounds one-sided.
Yeah, it's complicated by the fact that we can't just look at Bob's behavior in isolation. We have to look at it in the context of their relationship. And that's sort of like the self-actualized pinnacle of any relationship. And you can only get there if everyone tangos their way to the top.
Right.
But if your partner doesn't follow suit or lays into you when you blame yourself, so to speak, and take responsibility and doesn't take responsibility for their side, then it's almost impossible to do this.
Yeah. It's humiliating.
Yeah. It even though you're trying hard, it's like, okay, I'm going to take responsibility. I'm going to stick on my side of the lawn, so to speak. And, and then the other person doesn't. Or the other person even ridicules you, like it's hard. It's almost impossible to like hold on to that, especially if you have disorganized attachment, you know what I mean? So it's a process. It's something that people cultivate together. It's not it's not a personality trait. I said.
Yeah, definitely for us cultivating together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of work that you and Colleen have done is, you know, just, it's just a mountain of work, right?
Oh, a lot of hours. A lot of hours in front of a couple counselor. Yeah, long time.
Yeah.
Years.
Repetition. Practice.
Absolutely.
Checking in.
Yeah.
Getting perspective.
Yeah.
You know, like it wasn't something that you just, that just happened.
No, no. And years of my own personal therapy. I mean, just years.
Yeah.
30 years.
Yeah. You know, I get emails from people saying that they feel hopeless and discouraged, that, because I'll say that, I'll be like, yeah. I'll give smaller estimates, you know, shorter estimates. I'll just right. be like, you know, because people will be like, okay, I have disorganized attachment or I have borderline or something, you know, right. and I've been in therapy for a year and a half and I don't see any change.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, well, it's not likely to see change of any significance in a year and a half of yeah. therapy. The borderline people I've treated with interpersonal therapy, I'd say 5 to 7 years before you see, like, you know, real symptom reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And people are like, what, you know, DBT is supposed to cure you in 10 weeks. You know what I mean? Like those kinds of claims you'll see online.
Sure. That's a misunderstanding of stages in therapy.
What do you mean?
DBT has this, they do this metaphor in DBT is like if you're one of the classic people who shows up, you have the trouble with the suicide and self-harm impulses and so forth. You spend the first year getting your butt out of hell, that you're just in hell. And once you're out of hell, you're in quiet suffering, which means the one thing that's mainly shifted is I'm not doing my, what they call target behaviors like self-harm and so forth. But I don't really have, nothing really else is better, but it's sort of like, in order to make it better, I got to stop from making it worse. So, you know, that can take longer than a year. I've had students in my class longer than a year.
Right.
But year's just the rule of thumb. And then you're in quiet suffering, which means you're miserable, but you don't have a life that's feeding your soul or making you happy. You're just not doing things to make it worse. And that they call that stage two. And there isn't a lot of data on it, how long it takes to get through. But a lot of it is directly working with people's trauma, because most people that have those kinds of impulses have some kind of traumatic history or whatever. So,
and also experiential relationships that are positive,
yeah,
that prove that people can be trusted and that
yeah.
they are in fact lovable.
Yeah.
That takes years and years
yeah.
for it to really sink in.
Right. Nobody has any data on how long it takes to move from out of hell to having just a life with ordinary problems, which is they call stage three. Just a life like everybody else's with ordinary problems.
Right.
Nobody has any data on that. There's not a lot of research. I'm not aware of any research on it.
It's expensive.
You know? Oh, yeah.
There's research on how interpersonal therapy can, the percent, I can't remember, but interpersonal psychodynamic therapy with yeah. borderline, something like 1 or 2 years is, I think, the point where you start seeing, say, 30% of the participants having subclinical symptoms of borderline.
Got it.
I can't remember. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
Obviously, people out there, but there are some data around that kind of thing. So, Patreon Molly, you go on to say, I'd love for you to talk on the reality of psychotherapists who are partnered romantically with non-psychotherapists.
Oh.
How do you navigate those relationships so that the therapist doesn't just extend their work into the relationship?
Indeed.
I find this really difficult and challenging.
Yeah.
As with most psychotherapists, I am empathic, caring, compassionate, and sometimes I don't want to listen empathically or with an ear for trauma and cognitive distortions, but it's really hard not to avoid that. Bob, what do you think?
I say turn the camera inward. That what you do in therapy is you turn the camera outward. You pay attention to your client, what their experience is, and you're listening that way. But if you're doing that, I should just speak for myself. If I do that in my relationship, then I'm doing... I tell you that story. The therapist I went and saw, a psychologist, give a talk, David Whalen. David Whalen, you ever heard of that guy? Doesn't matter. He gives a talk about self of therapist. Is that what they call it? Self of therapist?
Yeah.
And he says, oh, I learned all my clinical skills when I was 6. He describes a difficult childhood, particularly with his mother. Right. So anyways, if I act like therapist in my relationship, I'm avoiding me. And so my focus is in the wrong spot. So instead of, it isn't that I'm not empathic towards Colleen, but if I'm doing that, I'm there's a potential that I'm paying attention to her as my focus. My focus on her is a I don't love this language, a defense mechanism. And what's difficult is, how do I feel? Like, it's uncomfortable for me to pay attention to that. So I don't know if I'm like, if Molly's like me, but if she is, then when she finds herself doing that, I would pay attention to self. Like, oh, what's leading me into my empath role or whatever it is I want to call it? What am I avoiding?
Yeah, excellent. Thanks. I like that. It's a defense to analyze other people potentially. In the face of difficulty, you could imagine you're in a tense situation with your spouse and you're starting to be hurt. You're starting to get angry. You're starting to wonder if it's your fault. And you have self-esteem in analyzing other people because it's your job.
Yeah.
And so you slip into that and that's what you focus on.
Right.
And then you start to exhibit that to your partner.
Right.
You're only doing this because of blank, and then that leads to problems.
Yeah.
So focusing inward is like, okay, well, wait, why am I going there?
Right.
Why am I going to analytical mode right now?
Right.
The other thing I'll say to this is, because this is a question that I often get from people, and I find that no experienced therapist worries about this. Like, I don't know any colleague of mine who was like, or struggling with this, who was like, yeah, you know, when I go home to my spouse, I just can't turn it off.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've never heard anyone say that to me.
Yeah.
I only hear people saying they're worried about it or they're curious about it.
Right.
But I've never heard a therapist say that that's a problem.
Yeah.
Because there's certain premises in that question that aren't true. I think one premise is that analyzing other people is a bad thing.
Yeah.
But it's not a bad thing.
Right.
We all do it.
Sure.
When your spouse comes home from work and you kind of detect they're in a bad mood and then they bark at you, you analyze that and say, like, did something happen at work?
Yeah.
You don't just ignore that information,
right.
You know, and you might even say something like, did something happen at work?
Yeah.
The ability to understand people, if you really, really understand people accurately, only leads to compassion for them.
Oh, yeah.
And what a wonderful thing to have for your spouse.
Right.
When they're in a bad mood and they're barking at you after work and you're able to see through that and able to see that they're suffering and you react to that suffering rather than the barking.
Yeah.
What a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And your spouse isn't going to complain about that. your spouse is going to be very happy that you don't react to their bad behavior, you know? So now the problem is, again, as we were talking about earlier, if you use an analysis to attack, and that's not actually analytical. That's just a trick that you're playing on yourself that you think is clinical when in fact it's just a veiled attack that anyone is capable of.
Yeah, you know, the other thing we do is we put focus on the other and it ends up being an avoidance of me. So like my spouse comes home, they're in a bad mood, they bark at me. I might have compassion for them or I might have hurt feelings and I might say, hey, you know, that hurt when you talk to me like that, which isn't like, hey, you're an asshole. More like, ouch, that hurt. And saying ouch, that hurt is a completely legitimate thing to do and often very useful feedback for their partner about the impact they're having on you. And doesn't preclude having compassion for them. Doesn't mean that you can't, or that you can't hold both ends. Of course you can hold both ends.
Right.
I once treated a couple where one of the partners was a couple counselor, right? Did the same kind of work that I do. And one of the things that we learned is that they had an enormously hard time slowing down and paying attention to their own experience, and that somehow when there was conflict, it's like they had this reflex to focus on the partner and there's a whole world happening inside that they didn't have access to and felt really uncomfortable accessing and learning about and also sharing. And yet at the same time, as they developed their ability to do that, their relationship improved.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in part because their partner felt like, oh, you're really there. you really are there. Oh, I'm having an impact on you, and I can actually see it in the tears in your eyes or in the ache in your heart, as opposed to that sort of Florence Nightingale super compassion, you know, where you have no pain because you can absorb it all, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon that's not intuitive, I think, to a lot of people, that to have emotional problems,
yeah,
to be hurt by your spouse, to be affected by your spouse, is somehow an appealing quality.
Oh yeah.
You know, to your spouse, right? Uh-huh. That it goes against our cultural notions of,
right,
of being strong,
sure,
not being a whiner,
self-sufficient,
not being needy.
Yeah, right, needy. Oh, that's a biggie.
Yeah. These are usually things we self-judge, not things that we tend to judge in other people in general, of course.
Right.
Anyway, before we go to break, I want to read a poem that I think someone might have sent me. I'm not quite sure. It's on psychotherapy.net, and it is written by Carrie Mulholland. And it's sort of interesting, and then we'll go to break. In that billowing silence, a silence to loathe and love, like the first gasp of submersion at the pool. In that silence, I examine the paintings on your wall and the thin splits between the floorboards, the leavings caught in them, crumbs and dust, and once a tiny blue bead. In the roaring silence, while I scrambled away from the edges, I came to know well the hem of your skirts and the lay of your hands on your lap, still. Each Tuesday, I sat in the corner of your couch, ringed by a wreath of damp tissue. You rocked in your chair. Sometimes I thought you were a beatific witch, just waiting with your gentle prods to send me back into the seas, to push me under over and over. Sometimes I thought you invented the pearl I sought, a mean joke on me. I thought you knew what I was going to say next, knew my interior as if it were written in a code for which you held the key. Sometimes I liked this, then I didn't. How still our bodies were, while I dangled over the fire at the bottom of my darkest pits, writhed? I've never heard of that word, writhed. Writhed in the salt of my ordinary wounds. How quiet and desperate that year of weekly hours. How sessions of light dwindled and blossomed across the planks of your floor. How my singular and universal dreads met and wrestled up under your watch. How I wanted to crawl into your lap and have you stroke my hair and say, there, there. And how, in a way, never touching me, you did.
Nice poem.
Yeah. I like that last. I want to read that last bit again. How I want to crawl into your lap and have you stroke my hair and say, there, there. And how, in a way, never touching me, you did. There's just something really observant about that.
Indeed. Good writer.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, these little details that poets will alert us to, right? That those little things you notice in your therapist's office, kind of subconsciously,
right?
You know?
I've gotten to making them conscious. I say to my clients often, where do your eyes want to go? Do you have your spots picked out? Because everybody picks their spots and they all point. They know exactly where they're pointing, where they're looking.
Yeah.
And usually there's something connected to the look. Like one fellow the other day, just looking down at the floor. And I'm like, I noticed that your eyes went down. And he said something so insightful. He said, when I express hope, I feel ashamed. Mm. Really interesting. And so I was, knocked me over with a feather. It was so fast. Mm. Such a fast insight. Such a great self-awareness. Really impressive. Anyways, the point is that everybody picks their spots. Mm. The eyes just go where they go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they also avoid spots. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like what?
Usually eye contact with either partner, if it's a couple, or me, or both. Almost like a wish to not be seen. Mm. Yeah. So this poet disappeared into the cracks in the floor. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can remember certain things in my last therapist's office that I never really fully processed, you know, a little statuette on a bookshelf and or a little picture frame with something. And it never, even though I probably looked at it, you know, a combined, you know, 3 weeks, I never really looked at it, you know, and said, what the hell is that thing?
Right.
Sometimes, you know, I'll, at a certain, I don't know, threshold for clients, they will start to actually take that leap and start to interact with things in my office in a way that I think there was a part of them that, that always wanted to.
Curious.
You know, it makes sense, right? It's like when we're five and we walk into a room and there's a bunch of little goodies, we want to put our hands on those goodies. And we want to, when we're 18 months, we want to put that thing in our mouth.
Absolutely.
You know, we don't lose that curiosity as adults.
Right.
We just restrain ourselves, you know, because our superego kicks in and says, don't do that.
Don't do that. You have a lot of things in your office.
I do. Yeah. I have a lot of books.
You do.
And so the frequent sort of threshold that I'll see some clients make is they'll actually at some point say, I've been looking at that book for 2 years.
Right.
What is that book? I don't, or can I read that book? You know? Yeah. And you know, it ends up kind of being this unconscious, I feel like it's two things. One, I feel like it's a leveling of the playing field. Mm-hmm. I feel like the client is starting to say, I am important enough, or I feel comfortable enough or something, or you've made me understand that you're not above me or something, that I can actually casually just ask you about your office the way I might with a friend or something.
Right.
I'm not their friend, but
no.
But it is a leveling of the playing field, you know what I mean?
Sure. You're not their friend.
Yeah, I mean I'm friendly, but sure. I'm not in a relationship with them as a friend, you know.
No.
But anyway, the other thing that I think it is a desire to possess the warmth of therapy. To because the office often, as this poet, you know, I think exemplifies or writes about, is the office becomes part of the womb of therapy, if you will.
Yeah, nice image.
And we want to hold that with us all the time, and if we can bring those things, you know, they're probably just to some extent arbitrary objects. When I think about that, when I think about all the therapists I've had, you know, of course everything in there was, you know, just a convenient thing or some little knickknack they had, or maybe it was intentional, maybe it wasn't, but it was. It wasn't that important, but to me, those things had tremendous support. And I remember there's this one. Actually, he wasn't a therapist of mine. He was a supervisee, but it's a similar kind of a supervisor. Sorry.
Yeah.
And there was one statue that he had that was, I can still picture it in my mind, and it had tremendous importance to me. And if I could have had that thing, you know, and brought it with me and put it in my office so I could look at it, I think it would have that transitional object appeal to me the way a child brings their soft blanket with them wherever they go.
Right.
Have you ever had that happen?
Where I wanted something?
Where you've started to explore your therapist's office.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sometimes when I get there, he's got to use the restroom or eat something, and he's like, go on in. So I go in and I usually stand at the window. He has a view of the Seattle Center where the Space Needle is. So sometimes I look out the window and look at the traffic going by and whatever. Sometimes I look at the photo of his son. Sometimes I look at his business cards. Sometimes I look at the business cards of the people that he shares the office with. Sometimes his wallet and keys are there. I haven't gone through his wallet. I don't think I'd ever do that, but it's kind of funny. And a hat. He has a hat, which I never see him wear. So yeah, I'll tell you what, I walked into here maybe 6 months ago. And you have a lot of, not just books, but you have a lot of knickknacks on one of your shelves, you know? And I picked up one and I'm like handling it. I'm like, what is it? And you're like, it's a fly swatter. I'm like, ah! I look like a racquetball racket.
Did you think it was like a memorabilia?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I have a shelf with a bunch of memorabilia. Podcast memorabilia, childhood memorabilia, yeah. You know, past pets memorabilia, this kind of thing. And
right.
Apparently, Bob picked up my... It's a fly killer. It's the electronic... It looks like a tennis racket, and it's electrified.
Right.
We had a problem with fruit flies.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. And normally... You know, they're from bananas that you bring from the, you know, fruit that you bring from the grocery store. And then they live in the fruit basket and the compost basket.
Right.
And you put out that, you know, you get rid of the bananas and you get rid of the compost. Then you put out you put vinegar in a, like have a you bowl, seen this?
Right? Yeah.
And you poke holes in saran wrap.
Oh, right. Yeah, we did that once. It works.
They go in there and they die. And it fixes it, you know. Yeah. And so you might have to suffer a couple weeks with fruit flies. For some reason, I was doing that system, and the fruit flies weren't going in there. And I was getting fruit flies all over, not just the kitchen, but all over the house.
Oh, bummer.
And I was using that tennis racket thing to kill probably... you know, 10 of these fruit flies a day, and they were still showing up, and my clients were having to kind of push them out of their face, which was really embarrassing.
Co-therapists.
Yeah. I have them purposely in here to test your frustration tolerance. And then I figured out on the internet that they weren't fruit flies. They're, well, I don't know what sort of fly they are, but they live in your sinks.
Oh, in the sink.
There's a kind of fruit fly that species that doesn't live in the compost. It lives in the traps in your sink in any trap. So it could be in your shower sink, you know, the drain sink,
P trap or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And so the solution is to get boiling water and pour it down.
Of course. Right.
And so I did that over the span of, I don't know, a few weeks, and it got rid of them.
Oh, nice.
But for like, I'm no joke, like 8 months maybe, I've been dealing with these flies in the house.
Right.
And I didn't have any idea.
No.
And I feel like people need to know about this sort of thing.
We're learning all kinds of stuff out there today.
All right, let's take a break, and when we get back, let's talk about more ways to kill flies in your house. What do you say, Bob? All right, we're back from the break. If you haven't become a patron of the podcast, do so now. Go to patreon.com and become a podcast. That's the way we know you like this thing. Bob, I want to end the podcast by talking about wedding vows, because didn't you want to talk about wedding vows?
Oh, yeah, we're doing that today?
I don't know. We can do that another time.
Yeah, I'm not prepared for that. Let's do that another time. I don't think I have my wedding vows with me.
We can do that. I'll add it to the list of things.
Okay, I'll look them up.
I got another email here. Anonymous patron writes, are there benefits to being vulnerable in therapy? So I have a really hard time being open and sharing my thoughts and feelings. And this is something we have been working on in therapy since I've never had any close relationships where I could do that.
Wow.
But every time I feel vulnerable feelings, I just freeze and shut down and I can't express anything I'm feeling. Mm. And that's where it usually stops. I've been writing my thoughts and reading it in session, which helps. Mm. It feels terrible in the moment, though. I guess there's a lot of shame around my own thoughts and sharing them with someone, but it does feel better afterwards. Part of me wants to push through and see what comes of it, because every time I did, it turned out to be good. Mm. But the other part of me thinks it's terrifying and cringeworthy and shameful. Bob, what do you think?
Sounds about normal to me. I think we might have this view of self as somehow vulnerable means that there's a problem. And I think it's just normal. And there's a lot of data on that one, too. It's not just me that thinks that. So,
what sort of data?
That Brené Brown stuff.
Like you self-report data around vulnerability or something? Or...
You'd have to ask her, because I never read any of her books. I just know that that's her thing. That's what she likes to talk about.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if there's actually data. Maybe there's just a lot of, there's information out there to be had about the benefits of vulnerability. But I don't think we'd call it vulnerability if it didn't feel the way it feels. But it is normal, so, and universal. So I applaud this person, and I think they're answering their own question, which is, yeah, keep at it. And we can always just report the immediate, which is actually the hardest. You know, Dickens says, oh, no, it's the future that's the hard one, right? But I think Dickens got that wrong. I think it's the present that's the hard one. Anyways, saying, oh, I've got that frozen thing, you know, or it's stuck in my throat, or I feel the thing in my chest, or whatever it is that I'm experiencing, is that's more vulnerable sharing, and also perhaps could lead a person, or at least be a step towards having more insight about what actually is this moment. What am I telling myself about this moment when I'm sharing my inner world with, yeah, so and so.
And you could all, you could even just stay in the first step and benefit tremendously.
Yeah,
you know, anonymous patron, you say you struggle with talking about how you feel, but you're extremely good at it.
Yeah.
In this email,
right.
A lot of people could never write this email.
Yeah.
So you're doing great.
I agree.
And you could just stay in this zone for the rest of your therapy and cure yourself of the attachment problems that you probably suffer from.
The therapy relationship is a great practice
right.
round for, as my first therapist said to me, yeah, Bob, the kind of intimacy that you have here with me, you're supposed to find that out in the world. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? That was 30 years ago, so.
Right. Right. I mean, that's the whole idea.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Becomes generalized to
right.
the regular life.
Yeah.
And so
somebody.
Yeah. So you're already doing it
yeah.
In therapy. You're pushing the envelope
yeah.
by even just saying it's hard to talk about these
yeah.
things.
Yeah, bravo.
Yeah. And you could just, you don't have to go any deeper than that if you don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Staying in that discomfort area and just saying, I have vulnerable feelings I want to share, but I'm having a hard time sharing them.
Beautiful.
You're sharing the vulnerable feelings in that moment.
You are indeed.
And it's such a wonderful experience to be vulnerable, to express, to value yourself, to take that leap of trust to someone who deserves it and to receive validation and compassion from other people. It's one of the most important experiences that one could have. And you know, you're having them. So, you know, that's great. You go on to say, and won't it just make me feel more attached and harder to leave in the end? That's a worry I still haven't mentioned to my therapist. Bob, what do you think?
Bring it up. What a great thing to bring up.
Yeah.
The answer is, yeah, it actually will make you attached and will make it harder. And that's okay. That's kind of the way we're built.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about to sort of piggyback on that is, it's true. You will become more attached, as Bob's saying, and it will make it harder, as Bob is saying. But that'd be like saying, well, I don't want to go on vacation because I don't want to come back home.
Exactly.
It sucks to go back home
it
after
does.
Vacation because
yeah.
you like being on vacation. But does that mean you don't go on vacation?
Right.
Like, it doesn't, you know, it's going to be hard. And when that day comes, it will be sad. And it will be a loss.
And one you came by honestly.
Yeah. I guess another analogy would be, I don't want to have a pet because the pet will die and it will be hard. Now, that's a choice people can make.
Sure.
For sure.
Absolutely.
But I think most pet owners make the choice of just like, well, but to have no pet in my life,
yeah.
that's worse. So, you know, the future pain isn't a reason to avoid a lifetime of pleasure and attachment. The other thing is there's this weird bias in our society around becoming attached in therapy.
Oh, right. Attached. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, I'm too dependent on my therapist.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are rare instances where that can be, you know, identified as a problem if the therapist is fostering too much dependency, so to speak.
Well, then it's not about the client's well-being and growth.
Right.
It's about some need that the therapist, we've done a letter or two about that.
Right.
Where people have had kind of a lousy experience with therapists, had trouble with managing their own limits and boundaries and so forth.
Right.
Yeah.
But to become dependent and attached on your therapist,
yeah.
if you're there to cure yourself from previous attachment wounds, is a necessary part of it. you cannot heal from your attachment wounds from a distance.
Yeah.
You have to take that leap of trust and fear to benefit from the security. You have to experience that. That's the whole point. Your body is like, but people are scary, but yeah. I want an attachment relationship.
Right.
You take that leap and it's scary, but then you're received well
yeah.
and you're cared for and you learn, oh, I'm lovable and people are capable of love. You can't intellectually know that. You have to feel it in your bones.
Yeah, that's true.
And so by being more attached, you're actually doing the work. And yeah, it will be harder. It will be harder in the end when you say goodbye. The other thing is why are you worrying about the end? I mean, if for me, for example, and Bob, if you came to us for therapy, the end, quote unquote, could be in 30 years. not likely to last that long, honestly, because
sure.
most clients don't actually want therapy for that long.
No.
But most... And you can inquire about this sort of thing. Like,
sure.
do you plan on moving anytime soon?
Right.
You know, do you plan on terminating with me?
Right.
Retire? Find a therapist like me and Bob, of which there's a lot of us, who will tell you, no, as long as you're wanting to see me, as long
yeah.
as I'm alive and
yeah.
capable of sitting in this chair and talking to you, which is probably decades, then we're good.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah, so... luxuriate in that security.
But you know what's interesting? It strikes me, you help me if I'm getting this wrong, but I hear a person who's afraid of sadness, right? But sadness is just normal. Like, mm-hmm. you're alive, you're going to have sadness. Mm-hmm. And maybe what they're describing is how terrifying it is to have sadness. Maybe they haven't had the corrective experience of sadness just being sadness, which is painful, mm-hmm. but I hope I don't sound preachy. Nothing to be avoided.
Right. Yeah, good. We have a value in our society of sadness is bad.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily bad.
It's never bad. It's just like laughing.
Well I'll modify that.
Okay.
There's a difference between sadness, like yeah. grief and missing someone.
Yeah.
And wishing something wasn't true, I guess, or wishing for something to change back to the way it was.
Yeah.
You know, I miss my cat and my dog that died last year.
Yeah.
It's sad. That's not a bad thing. No. I don't run away from that sadness.
No.
But there's a threshold upon which it crosses when it's so painful that it's not bad, like, to be judged, but it's so intolerable that it is something to be kind of afraid of, right?
Really?
Yeah, I mean, don't you think, like, some extreme versions of pain and sadness are kind of scary? And it's valid to be scared of that?
Oh, I don't think there's anything invalid about being scared, and I don't think you're wrong either. I think it is scary. I'm just thinking it isn't dangerous.
Right. You're not going to die from it.
No. And you actually aren't harmed by it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the extreme, which I agree with,
yeah.
sort of a radical acceptance of, this is life.
And, I had that thought, yeah.
And yeah, it's going to suck.
Right.
But you'll get through it and it feels probably worse than it actually will be when it actually happens.
That's interesting, that sentence. Yeah, it feels worse than our anticipation is worse than the actual.
Right.
Yeah, which is almost always true.
Yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I think it's normal to have your heart broken.
Hmm.
Though as you were talking, I was thinking about complicated bereavement, which actually I think just ends up being avoidance of sadness, and so therefore it lingers and lingers and lingers. And I suspect that when we lose someone or I don't like saying something about pets because they're family members, but I don't have a better... When we lose someone, period, a pet or a family member, someone we love, we're probably forever touched to some degree. We probably are changed in some ways, but it's like you said, what are you going to do?
Mm.
Not get married? Not have a cat?
Right.
Right? I mean, you don't want to come to the end of your days and discover that you didn't live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anonymous patron ends here saying, P.S., I admire how Bob and Umberto are able to talk about themselves and their experiences. I've never been able to do that with anyone, but now I wish I could. Again, anonymous patron. You just did.
You just did. There's an irony.
Yeah.
Beautifully, by the way.
Yeah, I wonder how much of your self beating up has to do with your perception of this whole thing. I wonder what internalized voices are shaming you or judging you, because in your discussion about how bad you are at something, you're exhibiting how good you are at
Indeed.
It.
Indeed. Very articulate, very self-aware. Lovely.
Yeah. So maybe it's that opening up has nothing to do with the issue. It's that inner voice telling you that you're screwing up or you're not good enough at it or you're not performing well enough or something.
Probably hard to imagine a universe in which you are.
Perhaps, yeah. You know? So let us know how you're doing, anonymous patron.
Way to go.
And I'll pass it along to Bob as well.
By the way,
if people ever want me to forward to Bob anything, you know, just say, please forward to Bob or address, you know, Kirk and Bob or something. You know, if I see his name, I'll just forward.
You forward everything to me.
Then. Yeah. But sometimes I'm not quite sure if, you know.
Oh, what people want. Sure.
And I think people have this notion that all of us read all the emails or something. And it's like, I'm the only one who reads the emails. And if you contact us, go to our website, psychologyandstato.com, fill out the contact us page. Do not comment below. Feel free to comment below, but don't think I'm going to see it because I've limited myself only to the emails because that already is taking too long. It's getting to quite a volume lately that I have to limit myself just to those emails.
The problems of success.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I remember not that long ago, maybe even just 5 years ago, I would get one message or comment or something every month or something.
Wow.
Or maybe even less. I mean, if we go way back to the first 3 years, it would be like one indication of a fan, so to speak, every 3 months or something. Uh-huh. And often it was kind of an odd person, you know what I mean? Just kind of like, oh, you're kind of an oddball, aren't you? Like, and you discovered our oddball thing. But now, it's at a point where, having said that, I respond to every email.
Yeah.
And I try to answer every email on the air, too.
How many are you getting in an average day or week?
On an average day, 10 or 20, maybe.
Oh, wow, that's quite
maybe
a lot.
Maybe more.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that doesn't include the comments and all that kind of stuff. So at some point I'm not going to be able to do that.
That's a point.
But I'm still in that zone.
Yeah.
I'm at the zone now where I'm like, I can't read the comments. Yeah. I used to read every little thing.
But...
and often I'll see it. Stacy monitors that kind of stuff. And if she thinks I need to see something, she'll send it. And actually I told her to send things to you too. If it pertains to you anyway.
Okay.
So
great
letter. Huh?
Great email. I like that this person emailed and what they talked about. Good.
All right. Well, let's adjourn there. And Bob, why should people take care of themselves?
Because they deserve it.